Oh, good evening. We're getting close to the end of Bendoa, and so we should be thinking soon about what to do next. Somewhere there's a list that we've put together, haven't we?
What about the list?
We have it still, is that right?
Oh, it's probably
somewhere.
Somewhere.
I'll dredge it up. It must be somewhere.
Yeah, it's a couple of years old.
My goodness.
Time flies.
Amazing. Well, whatever it is, we're doing. Dogen's doing fine by us. So, we just finished 10 last week, or at least we did 10. I don't know whether you all feel finished about it. It's fairly long. And it's meeting the question of the heresy of saying that there's a soul that continues after death. And Dogen is saying he bestows compassion and extricates them from this false view. So he says that if you think of permanence, then everything is permanent. If you think of impermanence, then everything is impermanence. It just depends on how you think about things. In one sense, it's true that everything is impermanent. And in another sense, nothing disappears. It just keeps transforming. And as far as the end of us is concerned, we don't know what kind of transformation is awaiting us besides the obvious one of disintegration of the physical body. there are lots and lots of traditions and beliefs around it and stories about it, but it's very hard to find anybody who has actually come back to tell us what it was. So in Zen terms, we don't usually even talk about reincarnation very much, except in the largest sense. It becomes too distracting, and Buddha said so too. Don't ask questions like that. Just take care of yourself right here, right now. That's the most important thing. Pull out the poison arrow before you start fussing about what it is to live or die. And he ends by saying, in this one dharma, how could you discriminate between body and mind, or between life and death from nirvana? As you are already Buddha's child, do not listen to the blabbering of maniacs who preach the fallacious view. It's very nice to consider that we are Buddha's child, or a Buddha child. Causes translation is a Buddha child. there are times when we feel very small and very helpless. And to remember the Buddha way of awakening, this grounded earthly way of seeing all things as Buddha, of being willing to see the star as it's rising and be seen by the star. That's being Buddha's child. So, some of these questions sound like they're kind of complaining. And this next one is, is it necessary for those who focus on this zazen to strictly observe the precepts? I mean, geez, if we have to do zazen, then we have to do precepts too? And Dogen doesn't mess around. He just says the sacred practice of maintaining the precepts is the guiding rule of the Zen gate and the traditional style of Buddhas and ancestors. But even those who have not yet received precepts or who have broken the precepts still don't lack the possibility to practice zazen. Or as Kaz's translation is, they can still receive the benefit of zazen. Of course. The precepts don't make you into some star-like figure that goes around in golden glow. It just gives you a handle on your own life. It's a confirmation of yourself as Buddha's child. And so in our practice, precepts are essential and no big deal at the same time. It's how we live and by what we live as a recognition of our own true nature. So then they pursue the question, if people who work diligently in this zazen also combine it with practicing shingon or shikan, will it be a problem? So shingon is a version of Buddhism that Dogen practiced when he first began. And shikan is also a part of the Tendai school, which is like Vipassana. So, these days, this question comes up many times because a lot of Zen meditation, or presumably meditation in any case, is coming up in terms of mindfulness practice, mindfulness as a kind of medicine, a kind of cure for people's distress and physical troubles. Jon Kabat-Zinn has created a great gift to everyone in the Western world, certainly, by introducing meditation with and taking out the Buddhism and talking of it in terms of the mind-body connection, so-called, or the oneness of body-mind. And in a way, this question is like that. Is it okay if we can do zazen and practice other things as well? And Dogen said he never heard of any of the ancestors who properly transmitted Buddha mudra from had ever combined practices like that. He says, truly, if you do not engage in one thing, you will never reach one wisdom. He said this also, I think, in the Genjo Koan. Practice one thing. Know one thing and practice one thing. But this is, according to ancestors, properly transmitting Buddha Dharma. And that's a very different matter from trying to heal a sick body or mind and mind. And it seems to me that Dogen would agree. But if you're going to talk about the transmission of the of Buddha's own mind from ancient times to now, then that kind of transmission isn't the same as the mindfulness practice of Kabat-Zinn or any of the other ways that meditation is being used to good effect. It's a different matter. It's a different kind of teaching. This is one of my favorite questions because it comes up so seldom. Can this practice be carried out by also by men and women, lay people, or only by practiced monks? Only practiced by monks. And Dogen says, the ancestral teachers stated that in attaining Buddha Dharma, there is no distinction between men and women, or noble and common. Yes. When I first read this many, many, many years ago, this was a big question. I mean, it still is in many, many people's minds. It's a big question. Women and lay people also. You know, what is a lay person? And can lay people be transmitted in the same way that monks can? And you can get all head up about it if you want to, but the main thing is just the practice and the continuity of it through relationship, which is what transmission is. How we, in our life, in our heart, in our practice, do this thing, not just Zazen, but the whole aspect of what Zazen is for us. The love and the compassion that comes as us, as how we live in the world. You could call that a monk living in the lay world, or you could call it a lay person living as a monk, but who cares? If the monks want to get together and talk business, then they do that. And lay people don't come to meetings like that, I guess, although even that seems a little odd. But all these distinctions are all very superficial and very meaningless in the end. Practice is practice. Zazen is Zazen. Precepts are precepts. And this is our crucial question, this coming one. Therefore, monks quickly depart from their involvements and have no obstacles to wholeheartedly engaging the way of Zazen. But how can people in the world who are busy with their duties single-mindedly practice and be in accord with the Buddha way of non-action? How can we practice in the lay world, in this very often quite wild world? Dogen says, certainly the Buddha ancestors, with their great sympathy, keep keep open the vast gate of compassion in order to allow all living beings to enter enlightenment. So which of the various beings would not enter? He talks about various emperors who did a good job being emperors and still practice Zazen very, very seriously and long. And Prime Minister Ri and Bo served their emperors and diligently practiced Zazen and entered the enlightenment of the great way of the Buddha ancestors. This only depends on whether or not one has aspiration without relationship to being a monk or a lay person. And that's really important. Sometimes somebody will come along who wants to be a priest or to take the precepts and so something. And it's the kind of aspiration that often is a little off track, that it's about how I'm going to appear in the world. I'll be a little extra special. And that kind of aspiration or that kind of willingness is very natural. It's kind of beautiful to see ordinations and see a priest or a monk walking around in robes, especially. And it's encouraging. But the kind of aspiration that comes from the depth of us is different from how the appearance, how we're concerned about the appearance of how we appear in the world as somebody practicing. It's much more intimate than that, much more personal than that. So, of course, we do this, and sometimes it's enormously helpful. And it's pretty easy to tell if someone's really serious or not. Because it's a huge step if you're not wanting to be showing off a bit. It's a kind of deep humility that comes from accepting something like this. Dogen says it only depends on whether or not one has aspiration or willingness without relationship to being a monk or a lay person. Also, anyone who can deeply discern what is important or trivial will thereby have this faith, will be able to have this faith. Being able to discern, carefully to tell in our own mind how we know. We feel it. Needless to say, people who think secular duties interfere with Buddha Dharma only know that there is no Buddha Dharma in the secular realm, and do not yet realize that there is nothing secular in the realm of Buddha. I know. It's funny, isn't it? There is no Buddha Dharma in the secular realm. That's what secular means. Secular means that it's the samsaric world. But if you realize that in the realm of Buddha, there is no secular, nothing secular, then you might be able to see that you can choose which world to live in. There is a choice. It's just the way the mind turns. Sometimes secular, sometimes Buddha.
Stop here.
Of course we can.
How did we mention that nirvana is in samsara?
It's saying the same thing.
So I'm trying to...
So it's saying it a little differently, but it's saying the identical thing. It's saying that if you think you're in samsara, there's no nirvana there. If you think you're in nirvana, everything is nirvana. It is the samsara turn. In our mind, we see samsara as nirvana. In our mind, we see the secular as suddenly we see, oh, it's really Buddha.
Okay.
All of it. We just were calling it samsara or secular and butting our heads against it because it's dirty and painful and a lot of things we don't like. That makes sense?
Yes. I mean, I have to think about it some more, but yes.
Thank you. Good question. Sonia.
In a very short way, if you could explain transmission. I mean, we hear the word a lot.
Yes.
And in this practice, like, you can give examples if you want, or you don't have to. But
yeah.
Please, who decides who's transmitted? Do you feel it? Or somebody said, you know, you've practiced long enough, I see you've sewn your robes, you know.
Yeah.
When does it happen?
And you know,
ongoing, or once it happens, okay.
All very good questions. and it's confusing because there are two versions of it. And one is the sort of secular version, I would say, almost, which is hierarchical. And it's about how you form yourself in terms of the social setup of practice, we gather together as sanghas, and if it's a very large sangha, it's quite unwieldy for very many people to live together in one group and not have it very highly organized. And so out of that organization came a version of transmission that meant that if you stuck around and were a hard worker, that you would get transmission and get to be maybe the director, and then you could be one of the teachers. Presumably, you try to pick the teachers through the more subtle transmission process, which is about an intimate face-to-face relationship with your teacher. And ultimately, in the biggest sense, transmission is happening all the time with everything that we meet. Every living and not living thing is transmitting to us, and we to it, them. So that's the part that's the most important. And the rest of it is a more or less important. The face-to-face with a teacher is important because it carries forward Buddha's mind and teaching. It carries the tradition of Buddha's faith all the way from way, way back 2,000 years ago, all the way to here, to each student, each teacher, so-called. So it isn't about learning something. It isn't about getting something. It's about recognizing in yourself and being recognized at the same time. It's a mutual recognition. So it has to happen both sides in order for it to be what I would call authentic.
So that's the important work as far as the self-work and then with the teacher. But then what about the actual... That has nothing to do with ordinations, right? Or it does?
Well, it does have to do with ordination. If a teacher is serious about her work, she won't ordain anybody who isn't already ordained. I mean, in the sense that when you do a wedding ceremony, the people who are getting married have already committed to each other before they get up to the altar. And it's just, it's a recognition among everybody of this thing that has happened.
So can I ask you a personal question, and you can or don't have to answer?
Sure.
So when your teacher decided, you know, I mean, I don't know how you came to your practice, whether you knew you wanted to teach.
I did not.
Right. But it's happening day by day.
Yes.
Without you knowing.
Well, he threw me into it because I created with all my friends, we all created Jikoji with the plan that that was a place for Koban to teach because we felt his teaching was so precious. And he needed some place where he could come and be safe and people could come to him. And he was agreeable to that and helped us get the use permit and all the things that had to be done. And then he took off and moved to New Mexico and said, bye-bye, take care of things. And then every now and then he would say he would promise to come and sit with us. Sometimes he would, sometimes he would not. And when he didn't, nobody knew what to do. And they all ran around, oh, we have Sashin, and oh, everybody's coming, and Cohen's not here. And so I just kind of did it instead of him. I just kind of filled up the space. I didn't know how to give a talk. It scared me to death. I was a very shy and quiet person, and I didn't really mean to be there, but I was there. And I was so desperate for Jikoji to be what it was that I was willing to hold it together until he could come back. And that's how it happened. It was very weird, really, because there was no ceremony for my ordination. My first Rakusu, there was a little teeny ceremony at Haiku Zendo. And I was so overwhelmed. I wept and I was bowing to everybody. All 17 little cushions had somebody, and I was doing prostrations. And it was crazy. And I think he just thought I was too nuts to do it in the proper way. So,
as in Colvin.
Yeah. So he had me sew a brown robe without having me sew a black robe. The first Rakusu he gave me was a purple one, which is for high abbots of some great degree, which is ridiculous. Silk, beautiful purple silk that I wore out completely at Jikoji. When he had me sew the brown robe, he didn't tell me anything about what a brown robe was. He just said, why don't you go and talk to Blanche and go stay at Green Gulch for a while. So I did that, and when I brought my fabric up there and showed it to people, they were aghast. This must be a mistake. Why are you sewing the brown robe?
But he told you to.
He did.
And he knows all the form.
He does.
It's not like he doesn't.
Absolutely.
So he was messing with you.
He was messing with me and with them.
With them, too.
Especially them.
Yes.
Yes.
Because they knew the forms.
They knew the forms, and it was broken with my coming there. Yeah. And then he didn't give it to me for three years. I gave it back to him when I was done, and then forgot about it. And then in Sesshin one night, somebody came in tears because her grandma had just died. And so Coben called us all together, and he had a memorial service and did some chanting, and we all did some chanting. And then he said to me, "Come on up to the altar." I said, "Who, me?" And he had my robe there. And he put it on my head. We did the Dai Zai three times, and then he put it on me, and then we walked out, and he said, "Now you know, this isn't really your robe." I said, "I know that." He said, "If somebody comes from visiting in Japan and has forgotten their robe, you can let them wear it." That was all the teaching or instruction he gave me about how to put it on. Nothing. But and then I didn't wear it until Blanche insisted on my going with her to Japan and bringing the robe so I could learn how to wear it. She was kind of annoyed with him that he didn't even teach me anything. But that's the way he was. And it was what it was. It was very, very unconventional, and took Zen Center a long time to accept that it was real.
Your situation or his whole way? Because, I mean, did he treat all his students like you?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, yeah. He wanted to keep it real.
I see that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's dug up, and, mm-hmm. you know, you've practiced and almost throw away the form and just really practice.
Yes. Because that's where the truth of it is.
If you're really not strong, you would fall apart.
Yes. And yet there's great reward in it, of course.
Just understanding? Or more than that?
More than that.
What's more than that?
It's like growing a garden. It's such a joy to see it flourish. Well, it's exactly 8 o'clock. Thank you for that question. Very good. I'd like to share that story because it's not the usual one. But now it's yours, too. My gift to you.